You're listening to the Relationships Made Easy podcast, episode 34.
You are listening to the Relationships Made Easy podcast with Dr. Abby Metcalf. Change your relationship even if your partner won't do a thing.
Hey everyone, I'm Dr. Abby Metcalf. Welcome back to the Relationships Made Easy podcast. I'm super excited about today. Yeah, I say it every week, get over it. Because I'm having my first guest on the podcast. It was about time, wasn't it? You all get tired of hearing me. And you're going to hear today from Gary Sollier, Dr. Gary Sollier, who is a transformational relationship coach. And I've known Gary for about 6 years, and his deal is that he helps people rewrite the rules for love in their brains. I mean, how great is that? So, and he's a national speaker. He's been a featured expert on a bunch of like celebrity TV and radio shows, like the Hay House Radio. And he's the creator of the Safe to Love Again workshop and the Extraordinary Couples Retreat. So he does both of those. And he's the author of this forthcoming book, which is coming out right around the podcast, called Safe to Love Again, How to Release the Pain of Past Relationships and Create the Love You Deserve. And he has this really unique blend of NLP, for those of you who don't know who that is, it's neuro-linguistic programming, and attachment theory, and a lot about the science of relationships, which you know I love because I like when things are grounded in actual research. So without further ado, we're going to switch it over to our interview with Dr. Gary Sollier. So I am here with Gary Sollier. And I'm so excited you're here on the podcast, Gary. Can you talk about why you wrote this book, which I loved and I really want to recommend to everyone out there, Safe to Love Again? And tell me why you wrote it.
Well, Dr. Abby, I guess since we're good friends, that it started a long, long time ago. I talk about it in the book. Where I grew up in this very dysfunctional family with a borderline mother, I mean, the violent type and the alcoholic type. And I swore I was going to be different. When I went to college, I was a psych major, had a religion major, and I thought, those two will get me, make sure this divorce thing never hits me. But then my senior in college, this professor, does this big personality inventory on me and calls me in for the results, and he gives me all the stuff, says, I've got a personality, thank you very much, you know, all those things. And then he said, oh, by the way, as you're walking out the door, you've got a 90% chance of having a divorce. And I was floored. I was just floored. It was like a bombshell. Within hours, I delayed graduation and decided to do a fifth year of college to get another degree in marriage and family. So to lock this thing down. So imagine my surprise when 12 years later, my wife says, I want a divorce.
Wow.
I had done everything imaginable. And so then I go through 7 years of therapy. Do all more, you know, I do John Bradshaw and all the gurus at the time, you know, the whole codependency, Pianelli stuff. And then I pronounce myself fit and ready. I've taken 10 years to beat this monster, and 4 years later, after being remarried, we're going through a divorce.
Wow.
And now it's like, wait a second. I have done my work. And what I realized is, although therapy had done a lot for me, it taught me to manage my pain, not to change my essential core way of relating. And when you manage your pain, you get a Groundhog Day effect. You keep living the same day over and over, except every decade, it seemed like. So, and that was when I said, if therapy hasn't cracked the code, then I'm going to.
Wow, that's incredible. And I know people listening can relate to this because they've been through multiple marriage therapists, or, you know, they've tried to change things and they changed for a little while, but then went back to the way they were. And then there's that feeling of, I'll never be able to change. You know, I'll never be able to really make my relationship different. So I think everyone relates to that. And so tell me a little bit about the book. There's a new theory of attachment here. I want you to explain to my listeners what that is and how that works.
Okay. So it might be good just to check in with them about, so they get an idea what their love style is, and then I can tell them what's under. Is
this? Oh, I love it. Let's do that. One of my favorite parts of Gary's book was this discovering your love style. So go for it.
Okay. So just listen in and see which one best fits you. So if, so the first description, class A, is I'm to some extent uncomfortable being close to others. I find it difficult to trust them completely, and so I find it hard to allow myself to depend on them. I'm nervous when anyone gets too close. Often, love partners want me to be more intimate than I feel comfortable being. I can only offer so much. So just see if that resonates with you. If not, then we'll go down to B. B is, being close to others I love is simple and uncomplicated. I'm relaxed. Depending on them and letting my partner depend on me feels good. In fact, I expect it. I don't worry about getting dumped or deserted much. Someone getting close to me is usually okay and feels good. See if that resonates. Or C. C is, I'm sometimes disappointed that others are hesitant or unwilling to get as close as I would like. I'm often concerned that my beloved doesn't love me like I love them or isn't as committed as I am. I want complete and total intimacy with my romantic partners. Yet my need for closeness can sometimes scare my partners away. Ooh. So just check in whether A, B, or C was you. A is what attachment theory calls avoidant attachment. It's where there's a little bit of a flight response going on. It's a, you know, from being dependent on or being in a relationship. B is your classic secure. Those are the ones who, as I say in the book, take no BS and give no BS. They're in a flow relationship with love, and they feel comfortable with being dependent on and depending on somebody. And C is your classic anxious. They learned somewhere a long time ago that love was there and not there, there and not there. And some part says, I'm going to fight to lock this thing down. The thing isn't going to get away from me again. So they have a fight response, and that, and sometimes they can be a little bit more on the drama side of things.
Ah.
And whereas the avoidant are more on the distant side of things.
Okay. So yes. Can you just give, to make this a little richer for folks who might be going, well, I'm all of those, or I'm mostly that, or mostly this. And so for anyone listening, trust me, you're mostly one, and it's especially when you're in love, when the risks are higher, that you go to one of these styles. But can you say a little more about what might have been in a childhood or a growing up developmentally that would, you know, that people could identify as maybe being in one of these categories?
Yeah, that's right. And back to your point for just a second, sometimes people say, well, I'm secure. And you can be relatively secure for 2 or 3 months until some part of you says, mm-hmm. I'm in a serious relationship. I don't know how many times people are dating, say, at the 2 to 3 month period. And then he changed or she changed or, oh my God, I started freaking out. It's when your system says, I'm in a serious relationship, then we find out what your love style is, or if there's been some sort of separation.
I love that. And so before we go to the other piece, because I just had a listener send a question to me, and she said, I was with this guy and we were so in love, you know, we were together all the time, we're doing all this stuff, and then he ghosted me. Yes. And then all of a sudden he was just gone. And they had been planning to go away together for a few days. And they were talking about that. And she was so excited. They were kind of going to this next level. And then he was gone. So does that sound familiar?
That sounds familiar. He's out there saying, oh, I've got this great vacation. I go to Maui. And then some part says, oh, my God, this is getting serious. Mm-hmm. Oh, remember the last time I was really close to somebody? Oh, my God. And then, oh my God, I've got a huge trip at work. We got to cancel the plans.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yep. Great.
Yep. So And what was the question again? Real quick.
So, yeah. So how are people, because again, because we said sometimes people will think they're more one than another. What, when you're growing up or developing, what are the kinds of households you might have been in to create one of the either avoidant or secure, you know, what are those kinds of households or what kinds of experiences might have been there?
Okay. So, you know, it all goes down to what, you know, Dan Siegel calls it all attachment is about contingent communication. You and your work and the Gottmans talk about bits. It's how do they respond to me? So for, like, say, the anxious, I mean, somewhere along the line, love comes, but they don't get a consistently positive response back. So, like, for instance, one form of anxiousness is one woman that I talked about in the book. Her mother was a pretty good mom for the first three kids, but then her husband died for the fourth, just as she was about to be born. And with the depression, she just was there. She tried, but then some part of her would be was overwhelmed, and then she wouldn't be. And then she could be there for a while, and then she'd go and do her grief. But while she was doing her grief, she was not there.
Wow.
And the little one said, well, mom's coming and going. Mom's coming out. How do I get this back? And it became anxious. Well, you get it. It's that paradise lost feeling. I get it, and it goes away, and I get it, and I go away. How do I get this thing to stay? How do I lock this thing down? And then you live your life in fear of when does love go away. That's one way. Now, the opposite way to get an avoidant is imagine the same child, but this time maybe an unwanted pregnancy. And and the father is a little bit of an alcoholic and so angry that he's had to marry this woman that he actually takes the bottle, this is one story I tell in the book, out of the baby's mouth every time he cries because he feels I got my life strapped. And the child then realizes, oh my God, and mom was not very present. So having a connection is the least best good option. It's a bad deal to be connected to that sort of rejection. So the system pulls away, takes the best option available. And so it's better to be alone in my crib than to have an angry dad taking my bottle or a mom who doesn't know how to deal with it. So the thing is, so there's a flight response. But the thing we want to make sure is nobody's wrong here. Both of those young babies took the best deal available. And we like that part of the book. Whatever that attachment style is, at one time it was the best deal available and it kept you on the planet. So nobody's wrong. Your brain isn't malfunctioning, but we do need to give it a new security protocol. It's like someone gave it a security memo, but didn't say when the expiration date was.
And so they're doing it the rest of their lives. And do you think that being in a child in a larger family has a, you know, with many more kids, has a different impact on this kind of stuff?
I think it can, but it doesn't always have to.
Okay.
You have to remember that for millions of years, the idea of the single mom or dad in a house raising two or three kids was not the norm.
Right.
For millions of years, there's a tribe. There's alloparenting is what they call it, where, you know, so if you're getting consistently good responses to your bids for attention, whether it's from brothers or aunts and grandmothers, and you know, that child is going to learn that the world responds to me and I am welcome.
Oh, yeah.
I am worthy. Someone's got my back and I feel cherished. Oh my God, someone's going to help me when I need it. I can be empowered. So long as those four feelings are being given by the primary caretakers or whoever it could be, then that child is going to learn that that they are lovable and the world is a loving place and it's safe to love and be loved. So it's really the feelings the child is getting based on how consistent the environment is. And I don't believe we have to have just one or two parents doing it. But so a larger family could work so long as the child is getting consistently great responses.
That's great. And one of the things I do talk to my clients about sometimes with all this is also their temperament. So kind of, you know, where they are in the family, like you talked about, you know, if there's an, if someone died, you know, in the, so that client might've had older siblings who were more securely attached because they were on the other side of that death, right? When they were getting a lot of those needs met.
Yes.
And I think that, so where you are in the family, when you come in and what's happening, you know, if there's suddenly a recession or dad loses his job or mom does or whatever. And then the temperament too, you know, who you are as a human coming out of the womb.
Yes.
I think there's sort of a perfect storm there. Do you agree with that? Or is that something you take into account? Or how does that work for you?
Well, I do believe people come in with, we know that there's some certain genetic predispositions for introverted and extrovert and some other things. Though attachment is not. It's not. It's not genetically formed. It is purely when you pop out of the womb, how does the environment treat you? How mom and dad treat you? Mm-hmm. So now, do I believe that sometimes these can impact things? Yeah, I do. On the other hand, you can, you know, secure isn't about whether you're anxious, whether you're introverted or extroverted. You can, someone can be very, very quiet, and but they are a wonderful spouse who listens and attends. They're just not going to go out there and light up the stage. You know, then there's the rest of us hot dogs that love it. You know, so yeah. Whatever your disposition is, it's whether does it work in the relationship? Are you being attentive?
Yeah.
If you're so out there as an extrovert that you're ignoring your introverted spouse, that's not going to fly.
Right.
If you're so introverted that some part of you isn't picking up the needs of your spouse, or it's you're feeling afraid to reach out, then that's more of an attachment issue, and it won't work either. So it's how well do you respond to kids?
Mm-hmm. That's great.
The feelings you give each other.
Okay. Love it. I just think it helps people, again, as they're thinking of their own childhood and their current relationships and sort of which of these matches. So I'm hoping my listeners right now that you're going, oh, I'm, you know, I think I really resonate with avoidant or secure or anxious. And we're doing this not so that you label yourself, but so that you can actually create movement. And I, you said something to me earlier, Gary, that I loved. And that was that in the past, a lot of this has been all description and no prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And can you speak to that?
Yes. Yes. A lot of attachment theory, when we first started doing the research, by the way, John Bowlby, when he started it, his wife said after his death in a memoir that he wanted to call it love theory.
Hmm.
But he was afraid that he was a British psychiatrist in the 40s. He thought the Freudians would kick him out.
Oh, yeah.
So maudlinly romantic as love. let's just be perfectly prim and proper here and talk about.
Oh, that's great.
and break off the tea.
I love it. Well, I like that you changed it because you call this discovering your love style.
I do.
I love it. I like that you shifted that energy of that.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with all this, sometimes attachment is an interesting thing. Like for me, when I was born, my mother wanted a girl.
Huh.
So much so that I found out I was dressed in pink for 6 months. But it wasn't until I was 15 that my aunt told me that I wasn't named for the first three weeks. And that the state had to tell my mother that you can either name the guy or we can put you in a room someplace in the county that you can have a lot of time to think about it.
Wow.
And she was not going to until my aunt said, name him after your two favorite actors, Gary Cooper and Dean Martin. Now I picked up a real sense of rejection. That rejection was always there. Kim came along and she finally had the child that could be dressed in pink, right? And I, of course, you don't understand this, but there was, so every time I would hear the word illegitimate child, because I was also the result of an affair in her first marriage, I would just get see red, because all these feelings around this birth were just loading up inside of me.
Wow.
So anytime I didn't feel totally included, red. So when that energy starts getting involved with your relationships, the next pays for the X. And if you really want to know what attachment's about, it's about these raging feelings we get early on if we don't get the four really good ones I talk about in the book. Welcomed with joy, worthy and nourished, cherished and protected, and power of choice. Those are the four feelings that tell you you're really loved as a 1 or 2 year old child. Mm-hmm. If we get other ones like unwelcome, which I got really well, and unworthy, and you know, or uncherished or disempowered, then those feelings are always there being instigated by all sorts of things, and it just plays havoc with our relationships.
Wow.
And so we need a calm brain. And a calm brain needs these four feelings. The other feelings don't create calmness. Mm-hmm. So when you really want to break down what I'm doing in the book, it's telling people how to feel in a relationship at their core so they can give and receive great love instead of these other less than wonderful feelings.
Mm-hmm. I love that, because I think that, again, when folks come to me and when I get questions from listeners and readers on my blog, one of the things they've lamented, I think, is that they would go to therapy and talk about this stuff, and which in itself can be good and cathartic, and you can have some ahas, and that's all great. What's next? And so what I liked about the book was that there was this hope and this way to this prescription, this way to actually move forward, as opposed to, well, here's this diagnosis you have, for lack of a better term, you know, here's this thing you have, this box we're putting you in. And so, well, now you know. And I really appreciate that there's now you know, and now what do we do? You know, how do we move forward? So I love that.
Yeah, I mean, the point is not to give somebody a better story to explain how they got here. It's to show them a roadmap back to the person they were meant to be, the love style they were designed by nature to have. Mother Nature designed you to have a bond. Everything about evolution, you know, has pointed to a brain that can bond with immaculate intimacy and precision. And it's about the road back, discovering your true and natural best self. That some part gave up for good reasons, but now if we can just give you these four feelings back, you know, then that, if a brain that operates on welcomed and worthy and cherished and empowered is going to be pretty good in relationships, going to pick pretty good partners. This is the road back. And if you say, oh, I'm anxious or avoidant, which you might as well say I'm screwed, you know, that's not so good. But if you can say, you know, all I need to do is just train my brain to feel a little more worthy so I can reach out for my needs, or a little more welcome so I can respond to my partner's needs and be responded to that, or a little more empowered so I can have a voice with choice, or a little more cherished so I can be in a we, I just get those back and I get my brain to feel that more often and give it, then I'm good to go.
Oh, I love it. So I do want to talk a little more about these four feelings that create the lasting love. But first, you said something I of course grabbed me. You say that love needs a calm brain, and I'd love for you to explain more to my listeners about what that means.
Okay, calm brain. Well, the first thing is, you know, we know from couples research, the Gottmans. I know you're big on the Gottmans.
My listeners know I love John Gottman, right, and his wife. Yes, the Gottmans.
I know, man. The thing that is, that struck me is he was able to predict breakups with 94% accuracy, which was unheard of before that. If you had gotten 10% or 20% predictive ability, you would have been hailed as a savior in the field for research.
So true.
He goes to 94%, and it's like Moses opening the Red Sea.
Incredible.
I want that staff.
Yep. There it is.
And because he did something nobody else did. He noticed physiology. Mm-hmm. He noticed when the brain was sending out distress signals to the body, cortisol, either anger or fear, fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And so when the brain goes into these physiologically aroused states of fight and flight, fear or anger, 94% of the time, love goes away within 6.8 years. Mm-hmm. So when I look at that, I realized that, you know, you'll see it in couples all the time. Habitual fights will wear you down.
Yeah.
It predicts a harsh startup, always coming at and arguing each other. But what really calms a brain? Nobody gets agitated, angered, or afraid of feeling welcome with joy. Of feeling worthy to have your needs met.
Love it.
Of feeling cherished and protected. Someone's got your back and empowered with choice. Nobody gets agitated. It's when agitation comes from unwelcome, unworthy. So what I know is that our brains are expecting a bond where we can flow with the experience, where a calm brain, where love can flourish. And whenever we have too many of these states running where some part is running with old memories or current stuff going on, nothing good happens for love, because the feelings that tell us we're loved go away in those states. Because these are the four feelings that tell us we're loved. If we don't get them, then we're not loved. And eventually we all say, I deserve better, but we don't know how to get there sometimes, you know. So we go next, as then some part starts it all over again. But it's really important to know that love takes a calm brain. Can I tell a story about this?
Please.
Okay. Oh. I was speaking in Austin once on a stage and a panel with about 300 people. And there was a guy there that run your traditional, he had a dating show on three cable networks, right? And I said something about being safe to love again, that we need to feel safe, calm. And he gets up and he says, how many of you want to feel safe? How many of you want passion, passion? Mm-hmm. He talks about all this and hot sex and all this stuff. He says, nobody wants safe. And he looks over at me. So I grab the mic and I go, you know, it's true. We all love passion. We love hot sex. Everybody loves that. I go, but let me tell you this. I go, ladies, you know, did you know that when you are making love, that your amygdala has to be totally dark? That's the one that runs fight and flight, fear. Or you don't have an orgasm.
Right.
If there's any activity in that part of your brain, it's going to be disappointment. You will not have an orgasm. How many of you like safe now?
I love it. Oh, that's so great.
Like calm now. Calm how you get excited.
Yes. Oh, that's so awesome. I love it. Well, and really, if you just took that, you know, down the sex road that everyone's always interested in, especially when women can't have orgasm, because it is a total letting go. And if you don't feel safe to let go, if you're the whole time going, does my butt look big, or what's he going to think, or will I look funny if I do this, or anything else? I mean, those are just the top things, let alone he doesn't really love me. He thinks I'm this, he thinks I'm that, whatever that stuff is, forget it. And I get these women in my office quite a bit. So I am so with you there. Calm brain brings you good stuff. And this is Esther Perel's, you know, the domesticity versus eroticism, right? In some ways. But I like what you're saying is there's a bridge between that. You really do have to have that safety to get to the eroticism.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Don't knock safety. Safety is what we all need to have all the passion and partnership we want.
Love it. Yeah. Love it.
If you're anything like me, you're bad at asking for help, like weirdly bad at it. I've been a busy gal for a long time now. Kids, partner, my own business, all the things that make for a full life these days. And my instinct always was to just white knuckle it and do it all myself. But I say it on this show all the time. Ask for help. You don't have to do it all. And meanwhile, there I was doing it all. And I finally changed all that, from my podcast editor to the person who got 10 years of photos off my phone and into albums I actually look at. I found amazing people to help me on Upwork, and I've been using them for the last 8 years. And you don't need a business for any of this, any project, any size, planning an event, sorting out something at home, finally handling the thing on your list you keep avoiding. Upwork lets you find, hire, and pay expert freelancers all in one place. With Business Plus, you can access the top 1% of talent on Upwork, and with AI-powered shortlisting, you'll get matched to the right freelancer in under 6 hours. No endless searching required. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to connect with top talent ready to help you and your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
So, no, that's so great. And so, and how do you, does your brain then know when you're loved?
Okay, so your brain knows you're loved. Well, this is, when I first asked the question, there's this funny, I had this funny month where all 20 of my clients asked me the same question. One of them had been to my workshop the previous month, and they said, hey, how can you create some sort of web, you know, workshop that in one weekend we can have a secure break? And I thought, well, that's a little tall order for a 2 or 3 day workshop. But it began, but when 20 people ask you, then I began thinking, so what really is doing that? And my mindset, I said, so what tells a secure break to be secure and that's there that the others don't have? What's doing that? And my mind eventually settled on an attachment theory, what's called the strained situation. It's where you take a 1 to 1.5 year old child and you separate from them from their mother. And based on how they show up, you can tell whether they're anxious, secure, or avoidant. The anxious babies go and play by themselves, and it's like mom never even left. They're not upset because they're not expecting mom to be there in the first place. They've already toned things down. The anxious babies come back, they're crying, they can't be consoled, they won't want to be hugged, and they want to hit mom at the same time. Those are your anxious. Why dare you go away? And then the secure, man, they get up, they get hugged, and then they go back and play. It's like, yep, new mom was coming back, glad to see her. Now, that and those track for the rest of your life. By the time you're 1 year old, 1 year old. So now, at 1 year old, as we well know, the prefrontal cortex, the most human part of us, isn't online, nor is the logic online. So there's no story. There's no story running here. There's no limiting beliefs. Everybody has heard about limiting beliefs. Limiting beliefs come on at 3 to explain what's already happened when the prefrontal cortex comes. There's no identity. I am, you know, I'm a really solid guy, or, you know, I'm a therapist, you know, whatever I am, whatever, you know, none of that is running. The only thing that's running that tells that baby they are loved or not is our feelings. Feelings. It's the only thing running, mostly from what's called implicit memory. And then I said, so what feelings? Surely not all are equal.
Right.
You know?
And they're not.
I began to look at from how, when I had gone and we had dealt with these early situations with clients, I went to something called Neo-Reiki and developmental. And I began to, these six, they talk about six rights that children get between 0 and 3. And you get from the right to exist in the first 2 months. If it's given well and you're loved, you get a wonderful feeling of welcomed with joy. Oh, Abby, so glad to see you today. Oh, there's a cute little one, right? I can see her in you, right? Then the next right is worthy and nourished. I mean, that's the feeling, because you have a right to reach out for your needs. You have a right to reach out for your needs. They're crying, mom comes back with a bottle or the binky or whatever else. Mm-hmm. Then you feel worthy and nourished. Then when you get a little mobility and you're a toddler and you notice, hey, mom's over there, I'm over here, I'm a me, and what's got my back? I need a we. Then you get this feeling, and mom has your back, she's looking over you, but you get to be a me. Then you get to have some proper support and you feel cherished and protected. And then the last two rights are a right to create your own experience and a right to assert. And if that's navigated well, then you feel empowered with choice. This is all happening in the first 2 years.
Wow.
So those reference feelings from getting that became my signature. So if you could feel welcomed and worthy and cherished and empowered, then you get what they call as the sixth right, the love and be loved. That's when your brain adds up the four feelings, the math, and says, did I get 4 from 4 in love? So what tells your brain as a 1-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a 20-year-old, as a 40-year-old, as an 80-year-old, are these four feelings that your brain uses as your GPS, reference feelings. Wow. Did I feel welcome? Did I feel worthy? Did I feel cherished? Did I feel empowered? Any situation, intimate, work, friends, I just take a moment if you're out there and think, when was the last time you felt unworthy and loved or unwelcome? Wow. Something's off in the relationship. So the new GPS is you listen to your guts. Did I feel these four feelings? And if one's missing, something could be worked on. Wow. Two's missing, you're probably thinking, what's my best friend's therapist number? You know, and three and four, you're in a toxic relationship and it's either get or get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oof.
So, no, I love that. And I like these four feelings. I think people can really, and these will be in the show notes, everybody, if you're, you know, listening as you drive, not to worry. But these four feelings to me are things people can really attach to and go, oh, am I getting that one or not? Am I getting that one or not? And they're current. So, and that leads me to my next question. How can couples create a great relationship that lasts?
Okay. A lot of times I have one little sheet of worksheet with the four feelings, rank them 1 to 10. And I give like 4 or 5 examples of what each one is.
Okay.
And a lot of times in the first session or two, when I work with couples rather than singles, I will just give them to them and say, hey, you know, what's going on here? And that will give me a pretty good roadmap. How, no, I don't feel worthy at all. But, you know, and then he goes, well, you know, I feel always controlled. I don't feel empowered in this relationship. Now I've got their dueling rights. Their dueling figures. You know, man, when I don't feel worthy, then I really criticize you and disempower you. And then when I feel disempowered, the guy says or she says, then I won't meet your needs and I'll make you. And now you've got a circle of bad feelings. And then you know that you've got to give both of them. This is the trick. It's not just the Gottman like skills. You know, well, we could give worthy by teaching him love maps, and we could. Mm-hmm. You know, give her more ability to give him empowered choice by teaching her, you know, soft startups, right? Or anything else. Neither of them had the right to feel, what I'm saying is, let me put it this way. Both of them had the right to feel, based on childhood, exactly the way they felt in that relationship. So I give his brain a right to feel empowered. Mm. So he's not setting things up. I give her a right to feel worthy. And then we put in the skill set, and then love takes off. Because if you give couples skill sets, but their brain doesn't have a right to reach out, so it doesn't have a right to feel worthy, it simply won't do it. It won't reach out. Wow. And if he doesn't have a right to feel empowered, he will not assert his truth. Mm. We give him back their rights. And then we show them how they've chosen each other for exactly the experience so they can thank each other and choose better instead of making each other wrong. Of course, we're both like this. And then we give them a skill set, and then they know how to give themselves and each other these four beautiful feelings, and love takes off.
I love it. You know, this reminds me, in your book, there was a line, I loved it. You said, a brain that has no right to love and be loved typically deletes a lot of signals. Mm-hmm. And I would love, because I talk about this kind of stuff too, like that we don't notice certain things, you know, that are in our environment. Can you say what you mean by that?
Yeah. One of the things we know is when somebody has a missing right to love and be loved, then they're always looking out for the day they're not loved. That mm-hmm. that filter then will delete all the time someone comes up and gives them a hot cup. Yep. Hot chocolate or whatever. Now so they don't notice all the good things. They're so looking out for the day loves, but they're not going to be.
Yep.
Now this partner walks in and is trying desperately and to love them, but they just keep deleting. As one client said, how do I deal with this woman who thinks she has no needs? Mm-hmm. Every time he tried to meet her needs to be a really good guy, she would go, no, 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 I don't have a right to be loved, and I'm not going to depend on a man, and I'm not going to have him reach out. And it was so frustrating. But all she could see is this, well, you know, what about this, and what about this, and what about this? Mm-hmm. Until she had the right to feel safe with being loved. You know, it's to know that if I reach out, I'm not going to have my hand slapped by mom. This guy just to reach out and say, what do you need, baby? Then that's kind of the way it is. We are always, we get these identities based on these missing rights. I was working with a couple in the fall, and she was prone more to very harsh startups, very anxious. You know, she would just immediately say mean, snarky things. You know, and I said something, in effect, I said, you know, one of the things we need to work on is just, is can we say that in a more loving way? And her first message is, look, she goes, you know, I'm just a little more vocal, and I'm just a little, and so I'm just a bit of a hothead. I'm a hothead. That's just who I am. That was identity.
Yep.
Covering up a missing right to have her needs met.
So true.
Right. So we got, so, and now what is she going to filter for? Things that, you know, that that feed into that aggrieved identity.
Yes.
And so once we started opening up, but look at all the other things that are going on. Oh, what if we could calm down? So we had to give her a new identity too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, because that other identity, I tell my clients all the time, you know, we prove ourselves right. And that's part of, you know, if we're so sure about this is who we are, then we will only see things that support that in many ways. So yeah, breaking that initial identity into something else is critical.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what if we could, you know, like I said in the book at one time, what if we could swap out those limiting identities, right? Well, I'm just always unlucky in life or whatever. What if we could, if we're especially in a couple, what if we could say, you know, I'm the one who worthies my partner. Mm. I'm the one who empowers.
Yeah, wow.
What if I'm the secure one? What if I'm the calm one? If we gave us that, right, you know, whereas most couples, you know, one of the things that couples, not that I would ever do this, is try to be right all the time. I'm the right one, right? You know, I am the sacrificer. These will not work, you know. No. But it, what if I'm the worthy one and I can give you this?
Yeah.
These are way better identities. And so what we want is an identity that can allow us to give and receive. It's got to be both ways. These four beautiful feelings.
That's great.
For me, I'll be honest, you know, dealing with my borderline mother, there were kind of like two identities that kind of came to be more in prominence for me. I found out that if you couldn't be found right, then you could get beat.
Yeah.
So I would argue that I was not wrong because I, you know, and if I could prove I was right. So imagine how that plays.
Wow.
That into a relationship, right?
Oh, boy.
I hate saying it, but, you know, a lot of women don't like that.
Yeah.
Because the opposite is everybody else gets to be wrong, right?
Yep, afraid so.
And then the other one was I found out in high school if I got logical, it would confuse her. And then she'd forget what was on her agenda.
Oh, wow.
So, imagine walking up into a relationship for years thinking I'm going to be very loving, I'm never going to get a divorce, I'm going to work my butt, but these things are still running.
Yep.
And I walk in and I'm always right and I'm always being logical.
Oi.
No one, to be honest with you, I understand why mother's wife.
Yeah.
I left her lonely and disempowered.
Yep.
Though I was trying desperately to connect with logic and being right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So these things don't work. And whatever it is, there's all these little identities where I'm the fixer, I'm the peacemaker, I'm the powerful one, you know, whatever they are, if they're not giving and taking these four feelings, love is not going to last.
No. So true. Oh, it's great. And I know a lot of people can connect to that or being the controlling one or whatever that is, but having that get in the way over and over and reverting to that behavior over and over, right? So, you know, you can shift for a little while, but not long.
People say, oh yeah, I know I'm OCD in a relationship. If you translate into these feelings, it's, oh, I know I'm the disempowering one.
Yeah.
Well, you know, who wants that?
What a setup. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just think, if what feelings come from the person I say I usually am in a relationship,
yeah,
then you understand what your why love isn't working.
That's great. So I think if everybody listening just even took only that away from today, you'd get so much that just to think about the labels and how you label yourself in all your relationships, but especially in your loved ones. So I have two final questions. Mm-hmm. And now in your book, you say that love is the operating system. And so how does love affect, you know, our whole lives, not just our relationships too, but everything?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you, Abby. That's one of my favorite chapters. I don't know how it was, but I began to notice I had a lot of entrepreneurial women that show up because I speak, and they often had their own businesses. And the very first entrepreneurial woman that I had, it was just interesting. She was always with taking. She had a missing link, never needs met, never felt worthy. All of her people were you know, boyfriends were takers, right? Or they were married, so she couldn't get everything.
Ah, perfect.
One or the other will give you the same feeling of undeserving, mm-hmm. right? And alternated. So when we started working, she got rid of the married boyfriend. And then we were working more. She got in a short relationship, and he was more of a taker. We got rid of him, and then we were full right to feel worthy. And pretty soon she pulls in a really cool guy that just loved meeting her needs. Then the day comes in, she goes, you know, I think my roommate is a taker. I think she's like all my other boyfriends. Sure enough.
Of course.
We had picked a roommate. Now, it wasn't that. Then one day she comes in, she goes, Gary, do you think this missing link of my needs is affecting my business? She goes, I can't charge my value. I'm always giving away freebies.
Wow.
If you're going to have to give, then that's that right went into the business. Another example of that was 1 year, you think it's just giving? No, it's not that. I had four women who were all seven-figure business owners. So they had a perfect right to have their needs. You know, they that was not the problem.
That wasn't the problem.
But all of them had what I call a missing right to split right to separate along. You know, they had more right to be separate than to belong to a supportive, empowering we. All of them had boyfriends, a husband that would sometimes fight. If they, like one said, I had to move, and he takes off the whole week of the move and then comes back smiling. Wasn't wow. there when I needed him. And nice. Then all of them had staffs that would flake on them. They had picked supportive staff, all had 5 to 7 people supporting. As one said, I just went on launch and 2 people on my staff went AWOL, my web designer, my other person, and I need them this week. And I simply said, like your ex-boyfriend. So, and then we worked on that. These rights, the brain takes these rights. They're really templates and permission slips for experience, and it swaps them out. Mm. For other experiences, like business and health. One woman I know that had a missing link to have her needs met told me after about 3 months that when we gave her back a right to have her needs met, she stopped going out with married people, you know, who wouldn't meet her needs. That was her pattern. And she goes, I don't know what happened. She goes, I'm 42. I've had anemia since I was 9. I've never been able to beat it. And it went away. Her body was mirroring her missing right to have a needs. It just wouldn't take in. Mm. And so at some level, whether it's health, money, finances, business especially, these rights, these templates, we swap them out. And it's like our whole life is being designed by our lifestyle. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much. Clearing this up here is really going to have such huge benefits everywhere else in their lives.
Exactly. I sometimes hear women often say, I got to work on my business first. No, 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 no. You work on love first, and we'll clear the business up as a result. This really is because it's set in early. This is literally hardwired wiring in the first 3 years. So the brain then just is set up to create unworthy or unwelcome experiences. And wow. if you think about it, Imagine you have a split right to love and be loved. You don't have a full right to be loved back. I don't know how many times I have seen clients who have been on stage that would walk off before the applause stopped. Or they just couldn't create that Facebook community where they'd be have a raving fan club.
Yeah.
You know what stopped them? Same thing that was stopping them in love.
Yes. Oh, love that. Okay. Yeah. And now, so how does a person, so someone listening right now, how did they learn their lessons about love so they can have this connected, fulfilling, soulful relationship?
That is a great question. The first thing I would do, as I told people, is these rites are like Groundhog Day. They keep showing up over and over, these feelings, the missing feelings, you know, the bad feelings. So you look at your life. Look at the last, and what's the experience that keeps showing up over and over again? Not the one that, you know, if you broke your leg at Tahoe skiing, and, you know, not that one.
One time thing, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing that's like Groundhog Day. And what's that missing feeling? Well, I never feel worthy to have memories. I'm never enough. Or no matter what I do, I'm not seen. So you're not cherished and protected. Or I lose myself in relationships. So I lose my power. Whatever that is, look back over your life and say, what's the consistent missing feeling? Is it welcome? Is it worthy? Is it cherished? Is it empowered? Then you have to do the deep work. You have to find somebody who can help you not just get a better story about it, but someone who can truly help reset your brain so you have a right to feel welcome and worthy. Then you stop, if you're single, you stop attracting Mr. Wrong. Because the way I talk about it, when you have a brain that's set for secure love, you know you have a right to feel worthy, welcome, cherished, and empowered. So they're Mr. Rights. Miss Rights. Not Mr. Right. They give back, they reflect back all of your rights, all of these feelings. So you have to do the deep work. And the biggest thing is to know that nobody's wrong here. Stop making yourself wrong. You know, some part of you wisely took the best deal available. The little Gary who decided to be right was taking the best deal available.
Yeah.
The part of you that doesn't reach out for your needs is taking the best deal available, but 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And notice that if your brain, if we can just get it safe once more, it will gladly take a better deal. Mm-hmm. And so there's always hope. And this is always done. And you need a community. We are born into communities. They're called parents, family. And you can't do this alone. You need a trusted mentor. And you need a supportive community of secure people, not the jaded boyfriend or girlfriend who's never had a good relationship in 20 years, but supportive people who, and so you've got to give yourself the right to reach out for help and to know that this isn't just possibility and hope. This is your birthright. You were born for this. And your brain knows that at some level. And whatever right it took away, it put in a layaway plan for you for the day you got bigger or you got out of that relationship if it happened in adulthood, so that you can go and get that layaway and you have it back now. So it's time to go get your layaway plan of whatever feeling is missing and claim that thing.
I love it. Oh, I'm so wrapping up there because that is beautiful and perfect and I think really sums up, really, if I think of the whole book, that sums it up. What you just said. And I love the idea, you know, we're not wrong.
Yeah.
We were truly doing our best at that time. And now it's time to do something different.
Exactly.
Because we don't need to be that anymore. So as we wrap up, just tell my listeners where they can find you.
Okay. They can find me at www.GarySalyer, GarySalyer.com. There'll be a link there to order the book as well. And on the side, there's also a video series of 2 to 4 minute videos that puts, yes, you'll be on my mailing list, they're practical advice. There's also some quotes from John Gray and Ariel Ford and people like that. There's actually one couple, this is so cool, that have already listened to it. They were both twice divorced, in their 50s, engaged, and about ready to break up. He ran across these love notes and, oh my God, we need to listen to this. It saved their engagement, and they got married in France.
Oh, I love it. Oh, that's awesome.
And I go over several things in the book. So if you have the book and the video series, you're going to get a lot of what it takes so that, you know, as I say, it's kind of my new motto for life. Everyone deserves a love that lasts.
I love it. That's great. So, and I'll, of course, link to all of this in the show notes. So you can also get it all there. And I just want to thank you so much for being on the podcast, Gary. It's awesome. I'm so excited about your book, and I can't wait to recommend it to clients.
Well, I want to thank you for being here. You know, we've been friends for about 5 or 6 years now. I love your work in the world. We are both on the side of helping singles and couples find lasting love. And, you know, it's been an honor to be on a podcast with someone who truly, for me, feels like a kindred spirit.
Aw, thank you so much. All right. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Relationships Made Easy podcast at www.abbymedcalf.com.